is Rory Spiegel and Ryan Radecki, and this is the Annals of Emergency Medicine podcast. It is March 2021. Ryan, how you doing?
Doing great, Rory. How are you?
Great, great. It's another good month. I think we've got some really fun articles this month, so why don't we just jump in? What do you say?
That's what we do every month.
Yes, we do.
Just jump right in.
We try to avoid your discussion about the weather as best we can.
It is lovely weather. I'm sure Thank it you is. For asking. All right. Very good. All right. You're up first.
So our first article is Extraglottic Airway Device Misplacement, a Novel Classification System and Findings in Postmortem Computed Tomography. And the lead author is Tatsui Nori. The use of supraglottic devices in emergency airway management is becoming more popular, with the recent publication of a number of large out-of-hospital cardiac arrest trials demonstrating their equivalency to the definitive airway management. They're a tool that most emergency physicians should be familiar with. But these authors point out that placement of these devices is not always as easy or straightforward as we think. And they sought to describe a classification system that describes the placement of supraglottic devices, types of misplacement, and any potential injuries that they're caused. So they conducted a retrospective review of deceased individuals who died following out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, had a postmortem CT scan performed, and had a supraglottic device in place. Overall, they reviewed 341 cases. The median age was 47 years old. 265, or 77% of these patients, died before getting to the hospital, and the remainder died in hospital. The classification system consisted of six components: depth, size, rotation, device, kinking, mechanical blocking of the ventilating opening, and any injuries that may have been caused. Under their system, extraglottic airway devices were found to be misplaced in 49 cases, or about 14%. In addition, there were 21 cases, or 6.2%, where there was an injury that was thought to be caused by the supraglottic device. And this included five severe injuries, which was about 1.5%. Three of these were pharyngeal or esophageal perforations. So all in all, it's an interesting study, but it has some fairly obvious limitations. Firstly, they only looked at patients who died, and they only looked at patients who died with supraglottic devices in place, so patients who were intubated later, or who had never been intubated at all and just had BVM performed, or patients who obtained ROS are not included in this data set. So it doesn't really represent the true rate of misplacement. Furthermore, this only looks at anatomic displacement and doesn't really describe how that affected ventilation. So, you know, something may have been misplaced or rotated or not quite at the right depth, but if you're getting sufficient ventilation, does that really matter clinically? So I think this is an interesting idea, an interesting study, but I'm not sure how much clinical utility we can take out of this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a huge selection bias here, and it gloriously overstates the actual instance of these traumatic injuries or misplacement of these supraglottic devices. But it's kind of interesting anyways, and there's beautiful pictures in here.
Oh, yeah.
By beautiful, I mean horrifying. There's this picture here, and you'll have to see it for yourself, but of a King airway, you know, where the balloon is inflated in the mediastinum. It's perforated the esophagus, and it's just totally paratracheal, and the balloon's in the mediastinum. You can tell that this was not helping the patient get a return of spontaneous circulation. But again, you know, again, very limited data set. These are the ones who died. Did they die because of other factors or died because of the small misplacement? Some of these are clearly dysfunctional, you know, for sure. But then again, you know, they needed an airway attempt to have a chance at survival. So rather than blame the airway for the failure to have return of spontaneous circulation, you have to recognize the patient was dead and they were doing their best. So anything here is a win. So that if you don't acknowledge all the patients who did get return of spontaneous circulation and survive to hospital admission, then, you know, you're inappropriately down
interpreting this data. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things to think about is we do now have large randomized control trials looking at supraglottic devices. And, you know, you have to assume if these things are happening, they happened in that study. Maybe we didn't identify them because we weren't looking for them, but certainly they must have happened at a rate similar to this. And yet they still had better, equivalent, if not better, outcomes in that group, right? And so you have to ask, how much does this clinically matter? I would say that it looks like all the severe badness happened with the King tube, you know,
well, yeah, compared the King to the other tube.
Right. Anything where you're jamming it down the esophagus and trying to inflate the balloon versus the other supraglottic devices like the LMA or the iGel. And if I remember correctly, the big randomized trials didn't use the Comba tube or the King tube. They had LMAs. So, you know, there might be a signal of harm in those groups. So I don't think this study can really show that.
No, certainly not. But certainly made for some dramatic pictures with this, again, gross selection bias.
All right. Well, you know, if we're not going to use a supraglottic device, Ryan, why don't you tell us why we should use a bougie?
Of course, we're going to use the bougie.
Yeah.
So this next one is routine use of a bougie improves first attempt intubation success in the out-of-hospital setting. Lead author here is Andrew J. Latimer, and they are up at the University of Washington. And this is just a little study that has ample face validity using bougie for first attempt intubation. As we've seen already in academic centers, at least with intubators of multiple levels of experience, that using the bougie improves first pass success with physicians. So now it's paramedics in the out-of-hospital setting. And this is just a simple before and after report of intubation success in the Seattle pre-hospital community after rollout of routine bougie use. This is all sort of typical rapid sequence intubation with sedatives and neuromuscular blocking agents. And their reporting period starts in 2015 and spans 18 months in a pre-period and 18 months after, and describes the attempted intubation of 823 patients in the before period and 771 in the after. In the before period, only 3% of patients were intubated using the bougie for first pass, as compared with 81% in the after period. The before and after cohorts were generally similar, although interestingly, CPR in progress intubation attempts bounced up from 40% of the before cohort to 50% of the after cohort, and almost certainly related, the frequency of Cormac-Lehane grade 1 laryngoscopic view dropped from 67% to 57%. First attempt success was 70% in the before cohort, with 77% in the after. The first attempt success rate was universally approved across all laryngoscopic views. Now, this is obviously not a randomized trial, so there are limitations to the strength of the conclusions you can draw. At the least, though, it doesn't appear there is any sign of consistent harms associated with first pass bougie, and probably more likely there is a small favorable effect, consistent with other evidence regarding the use of bougie for intubation.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is pretty consistent with the DRIVER study that was published a few years ago. The most interesting part to me is, and this also is consistent with the DRIVER study, that the benefit of bougie use was seen consistently through every single Cormac-Lehane view. So even the intubations that you would think were easy, you had an easier time delivering your tube when you used a bougie, which again speaks to this concept of using a bougie on your first pass before you even see what the difficulty of the intubation is.
I completely agree. It sounds like they, I don't think they're going back to the old way after implementing this study. I think that's probably the true test of whether they think this is a successful study. So they're probably using bougie at first attempt. We use bougie at first attempt routinely down in Christchurch as well.
Yeah. I mean, I've been doing it since I was an intern, so I haven't used a stylet in years.
Which is a very long time ago.
Yeah, now, I know. It's getting longer and longer. All right. Why don't we move on? So our next study, the prospective randomized trial of standard left anterolateral thoracotomy versus modified bilateral clamshell thoracotomy performed by emergency physicians. So the resuscitative thoracotomy is probably the most invasive procedure performed by an emergency physician. But some argue that the left lateral approach, which is the traditional one utilized, is not invasive enough. And it makes it difficult to accomplish the goals of a thoracotomy, which is to visualize and deliver the heart from the pericardial sac and to identify the descending aorta and clamp it. They argue that the modified bilateral anterior clamshell, which accesses the thorax through lifting up the sternum, gives better exposure, allowing non-surgeons an easier time to achieve these goals. To test this hypothesis, the authors performed a randomized trial. The authors randomized both senior staff and resident emergency physicians to the order at which they performed these two types of thoracotomies on cadavers. And they were timed how long it took them to successfully complete delivering the heart from the pericardial sac and subsequently occluding the descending aorta with a vascular clamp. And this was judged by an attending surgeon. Overall, 15 emergency physicians participated in the study. Approximately 50% of them were attendings, 50% were residents. The median number of thoracotomies performed by the participants prior to the study was 6, although the number of clamshell approaches was far fewer, at the median being 1. Overall, the success rates in the study for the medial clamshell and the lateral approaches were not statistically different, 67% versus 40%, though there was a 20% absolute difference in the successful amount of successful thoracotomies. The study just wasn't powered enough to show that difference. When they looked at the senior emergency staff in isolation, so excluding the residents, they found that the clamshell approach was better at 88% versus 25%. Overall, the clamshell approach had significantly higher proportion of injury-free trials compared to the lateral technique. That is, if you exclude the giant hole in the chest you just made. And the physicians themselves prefer the clamshell approach over the lateral approach when doing the procedure. So I think this is a very interesting study, and it's a nice way of looking at something that, you know, people often argue in favor of the clamshell once you become familiar with it. And they, I think, demonstrated the benefits of the clamshell from an anatomic perspective. Yes, their primary outcome wasn't statistically significant, but there was a pretty obvious difference in the ease at which they could do their procedures. But this, of course, doesn't provide evidence that it's an optimal procedure clinically, as it was done on cadavers. So it speaks nothing to the survival of the patients or the potential harms with this massively invasive procedure one does when you open the whole sternum.
Similar survival in this study between yes. arms is what you're saying.
Survival was identical.
Yes, I mean it's a heroic procedure, rarely performed in United States emergency departments. You know, certain academic trauma centers where they have the sort of cardiothoracics backup and trauma surgery backup to actually perform or attempt these procedures is great. So those are the centers where people are going to be trained on one of these two techniques, and I don't disagree with any of their conclusions that this is a better way. I mean, this is like surgery 101. Expose what you're trying to intervene upon. The better exposure you get, the more likely you are going to have a successful procedure. But probably not that. A little bit of difficulty generalizing from this one specific center and their one specific training program and these 14 cadavers to using it universally in all people. But there's other evidence and other people advocating for this bilateral clamshell technique. So certainly if this is what you're comfortable with doing, absolutely, this gives you permission to keep on doing it. If the left lateral thoracotomy is a procedure you've performed before and you're comfortable doing it with that method, stick with what you're comfortable until you've trained otherwise.
Yeah, and just to be fair, I mean, we say there's no survival benefit, but the survival benefit of thoracotomy is so low, you would have to randomize thousands of patients to even hope to show a benefit. And it would be very difficult to do without a multi-center trial in these large trauma centers. So this might be the best data we have for a very long time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a surrogate for a true interventional trial is probably the best you're going to get. Just as you say, you'd have to cluster randomize multiple centers. It'd be a challenge, to put it mildly.
Yeah, indeed.
Moving on to a less dramatic trauma article. The effect of written and video discharge instructions for mild traumatic brain injury patients in the emergency department. A randomized controlled trial. Lead author here is Amber Hook, and they are at Erasmus MC University Medical Center in Rotterdam. And, as opposed to doing clamshell thoracotomy, we see a lot of mild traumatic brain injury in the emergency department. The vast majority, if it even meets criteria for a CT scan, does not require neurosurgical intervention. And then you have patients who are quite sore, dizzy, fatigued, having trouble concentrating, sensitivity to light and sound, and other post-concussive symptoms. And this can go on for months. Giving patients some expectant guidance post-injury then becomes an important part of our care for these patients. This is a little study looking at the added value, if any, to a short video added to standard verbal and written discharge instructions. Specifically, a 4-minute video based on the Dutch national guidelines for mild traumatic brain injury. The hope being this better understanding of post-discharge instructions ultimately leads to better self-care and better symptomatology down the line. Sadly, no. In the 771 patients included, looking at their primary patient-oriented measure, there was no difference at 1 week or at 3 months regarding the severity of post-concussive symptoms. Then, as an intervention-oriented measure, recall of the discharge instructions was likewise no different. Anxiety, depression, and health-related quality of life symptoms were also measured, and, you guessed it, no different. There were probably slight differences regarding whether patients were more satisfied with their discharge instructions, favoring the video group, but the effect sizes were a handful of percentage points and unlikely to be clinically important. Like any single center specific bespoke intervention, there are also generalizability issues with their video intervention. So it may be the case that you can make a better video and you have a different patient population that's more receptive and more make a more memorable video and have a different effect size, but I would do that as a research intervention and prove that yours is better.
Yeah, I would find it very hard to believe that the improvement in the video would change this outcome. I don't know. I didn't watch the video. It's and you don't speak the language either. It's so hard to make a difference. You can imagine the same thing with like lower back pain, all these kind of issues that most patients get better on their own no matter what you do. And then there's a lingering group of patients that no matter what you do seem to have more chronic symptoms, and your upfront interventions seem to not really have much of an effect downstream.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not so sure about the whole concept of knowing how to take care of yourself working better for these specific post-traumatic symptoms, because concussion is so hard to manage to start with. Right. And there's so little conclusive evidence that there's any specific intervention that really makes people a lot better. There's a whole bunch of research saying graduated return to activity and early activity is a little bit better than worse activity, even though there's been contradictory messaging about this. So it may be a different subject, might be more... A different subject, different medical problem, different discharge instructions might be more amenable to a video discharge instruction. But this one, I mean, it's a nice attempt, but it didn't work.
Also, the question is how many people watch it, right? Like, we know that people don't read our discharge instructions. So how many of them actually watch our discharge instructions? the tree right. falls
I think
in
they
the
probably
woods.
Had to watch the video for these. That's another Hawthorne effect sort of thing. Like, I think in the study, they had to watch the video. Otherwise, if you're putting people in a room and just showing them a video, they're going to be surfing the internet on their phones the whole time.
Sure. All right. Well, our next article is short-term topical tetracaine is highly efficacious for the treatment of pain caused by corneal abrasions, a double-blind randomized clinical trial. And lead author is Stasia Shipman. One of the major dogmas in emergency medicine is that if you discharge a patient with a corneal abrasion with a bottle of tetracaine, they're going to burn a hole in their eyeball, leading to irrevocable harm. But as with much of the dogma in emergency medicine, the evidence supporting this practice is minimal. Essentially, this consists of case studies where patients used tetracaine for months, and not surprisingly, they ended up with a worse corneal abrasion, and some people blamed it on the tetracaine rather than the fact that, if you're having pain in your eye for months, obviously your corneal abrasion is getting worse. So these authors conducted a prospective double-blind randomized trial of tetracaine versus placebo set in the emergency department. Patients with corneal abrasions were randomized to receive either topical tetracaine or placebo every 30 minutes as needed for 24 hours. They enrolled 111 patients, 56 in the tetracaine group and 55 in the placebo group. At 24 to 48 hours follow-up, the overall numeric pain scale dropped significantly in the tetracaine group versus the placebo group. Patients in the tetracaine group were less likely to use hydrocodone than in the placebo group, and the rate of residual abrasion at follow-up was similar between the two groups. So I think this was a really nice study, but there are a number of issues. I think the biggest, I don't think there's much question with the fact that tetracaine is beneficial to relieve pain. I think most of us accept that. It might be one of the true parachutes in emergency medicine. We all see it when we give it to our patients and their pain is instantly gone. And for us who have an abrasion, we felt it. And so it's not surprising that this study showed a benefit and a decrease in pain symptoms. The big question, is it safe or is it going to burn a hole in the patient's eye? And of course, this study is far too small to determine this. Granted, there were no holes in any eyeballs, but with 55 patients in each group, it doesn't really rule out the fact that tetracaine could possibly be harmful. That being said, given the evidence that the originally used to support this claim is so minimal, I think it's probably safe to start using this in short courses.
Yeah, I think that's the key, the short course part of it. If you have somebody who only has enough supply of tetracaine to last 24 to 36 hours, they're not going to mask a worsening corneal abrasion and corneal ulcer development. I mean, it just has simple face validity, even though this doesn't have the evidence strong enough to actually say that. It's probably safe. It is, vision threatening if it's a complication, however. So you really want to make sure that you're doing this with the most reliable patients. I think the funniest thing, rather saddest thing, maybe, if you're a researcher about this study, is that almost everybody failed to follow up at their 1 week ophthalmology visit. Only 20% of their patients came back for their 1 week ophthalmologist follow up.
Well, that makes sense.
So you can see the natural course of a corneal abrasion is to get better.
Yeah.
And once you've gotten better, you're not going to come back for your eye exam because, I mean, Jesus, who wants to go to get an eye exam anyways? Sorry, right. Ophthalmologists. But it's still funny. It's just like, blah, blah, blah. There are 50 patients in each group. Of these, 40 plus didn't come back. back. It's like, oh no. Oh, well.
Right. But so I think
you have to assume, I mean, if you're doing it properly, you have to assume that they all had abrasions. If you're, you know, they all developed corneal ulcers. You have to assume that if you're properly doing, you know, ascertaining outcomes for missing data. But they probably all did well. And that's probably why they didn't show up.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that's important to kind of like the natural history of a corneal abrasion is to get better after a few days. And, you know, prolonged symptoms that someone would continue to use tetracaine for doesn't mean the tetracaine's harming them. It just means they're developing something that needs further follow-up. And I think that's the key here.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, and that's what we've been cautioning people about. I mean, the old studies that you cite from, you know, the 1950s and 1960s, yes, the concentrations of the anesthetics were just huge compared to what we're using today. And then, of course, if you're just nobody's following you up and you're just using it continuously, then obviously you're masking something more serious developing.
I'm pretty sure one of them was like a case report of an ophthalmologist who was like self-administering tetracaine in his eye and developed a corneal ulcer like after 3 months or something like that.
You should know better.
All right. Why don't we move on?
Moving on. A randomized trial comparing the efficacy of 5 oral analgesics for treatment of acute musculoskeletal extremity pain in the emergency department. Lead author here is Polly Bejure, and they are up at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And this is it, the grand throwdown of oral analgesia. 5 different formulations, head to head to head to head to head, for the treatment of acute musculoskeletal pain in the emergency department. The contestants: ibuprofen 400 milligrams plus acetaminophen 1,000 milligrams, ibuprofen 800 milligrams plus acetaminophen 1,000 milligrams, codeine 30 milligrams and acetaminophen 300 milligrams, hydrocodone 5 milligrams and acetaminophen 300 milligrams, and oxycodone 5 milligrams and acetaminophen 325 milligrams. So, patients could be included in this study if they had pain in one or more extremities and imaging was planned for the affected extremity. Patients were excluded if they had basically any sort of pain control in the last 24 hours or had contraindications to a study drug or had chronic pain syndromes. Primary efficacy outcome was change in pain score from baseline to 2 hours post-baseline, along with secondary outcomes such as adverse events and the question, do you want the same drug combination the next time you come to the emergency department? Based on their sample size calculations, they enrolled 600 with a goal of having 120 patients with analyzable data in each group. And they did this, and they just lost 3 patients because there was a failure in the dispensing mechanism, apparently, as part of the study production. And the winner was nothing. All combinations had some decrease in pain. All cohorts had the same need for rescue medications within 2 hours. All medications were basically statistically the same and had grossly similar appearing box and whisker scatter plots. No reliable differences between pain relief or desire to have the same combination next time. Opiate-containing combinations resulted in a little bit more nausea overall. On the scale of about 1 in 10 to 1 in 20 patients had nausea, rather than the 1 in 50 with the non-opiate-containing combinations. And then they do so many comparisons and exploratory analyses and hypothesize potentially that they could imagine a difference in which the ibuprofen 400 milligrams plus acetaminophen 1,000 milligrams was the least effective combination. But again, it's not likely that any of these differences could be demonstrated to reach clinical significance. So, as your first starting dose for analgesia in the emergency department for someone who hasn't had anything for their acute pain yet, some combination of ibuprofen and acetaminophen is probably your best bet rather than just simply initially escalating to an opioid-containing combination.
I think that's a good take-home point. I think the other take-home point is, time and time again, empiric single-dose opioids don't treat pain very well. We see this with every study, right? If you give a single dose of an opioid, it's usually a meager dose, you know, very few people get an adequate pain response from it. And that's because that's not how opiates should be dosed, right? They should be titrated to effect, whether you're using IV or PO. And so it's always, you know, when they're doing these kind of studies, whether they're doing ketorolac in renal stones or ibuprofen in muscular pain, when you're using a single dose of an opioid, you're going to get minimal to moderate effect in pain reduction. And so if you do want to use an opiate to treat pain, try to dose it correctly, which is titrate to effect.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's basically a good point because it's basically a straw man comparison between these acetaminophen plus ibuprofen combinations with, you know, clinically insignificant amounts of opioid. I mean, hydrocodone 5 milligrams, oxycodone 5 milligrams. These are fractions of the initial starting dose for morphine for somebody with true acute pain. So you really shouldn't expect them to get much of an effect. If you really wanted to test whether these are efficacious or not, you would have to use a much larger dose of the opioid and you probably get a better response. You'd probably have more adverse effects. But regardless, the takeaway here is that we just shouldn't start with opioid containing, you know, combinations. A lot of people get relief with just acetaminophen and ibuprofen. This is our routine practice here in Christchurch, and I don't think there's any reason to do it otherwise in the United States.
All right, well, let's move on.
Do we really want to do it? Did you prepare something on this tag one?
Of course, I love tag. How can I not?
I didn't know. I put it as an optional because I figured three and three.
Maybe. I saw tag and I jumped right at it. So,
All right. I'll let you do your intro into tag then.
All right. So our next article is new uses of thromboelastography and other forms of viscoelastic monitoring in the emergency department, a narrative review. And the lead author is Patrick Tyler. So if you read Twitter, everybody knows that tag is all the rage.
Yes, tag is all the rage.
At least on Twitter, tag is all the rage in emergency medicine. Essentially, viscoelastic monitoring is a point of care testing that gives the clinician a real-time view of the state of the patient's coagulation system. And so these authors did a really nice review of the technology and the evidence supporting its use. First, they discussed some of the downsides of our traditional testing. One, it's slow. Most of them look at various factors in isolation, and they don't really take the whole coagulation system as a holistic view. Next, they describe both thromboelastography, which is TEG, and rotational thromboelastometry, ROTEM, which are the most commonly used forms of viscoelastic testing. And they describe, at least in the transplant and cardiac surgery literature, there have been some studies finding an association with a decrease in the amount of blood products administered. In brief, TEG is essentially a cup where you have a needle going down into the cup that has kind of hooked up to a sensor. And then that cup rotates about 180 degrees bilaterally. And there's some great pictures of this in the actual review that I encourage you all to read. And if you were to put water in that cup and just rotate it back and forth, the needle wouldn't move much. But when you put blood in it, as the blood starts to clot around that needle, you get more and more movement of the needle in the cup. There's a sensor on that needle and that kind of picks up a graph of the movement of the needle as a clot forms. So what you end up with is this kind of like image of the strength of the formation of a clot. You get an idea of how strong the clot is at its maximal strength. Then you get an idea of the breakdown of the clot or the fibrolytic period. And so you get this kind of actual pictorial view of clot formation. And we can use that to make judgments on various deficits or various abnormalities in the coagulation system. And so they go on to discuss the potential areas that viscoelastic testing could be useful in the emergency department. And three of the big areas they talk about is sepsis, liver disease, and TBI, which all have their own unique forms of coagulopathy that may or not be truly represented by our traditional tests. Finally, they kind of discuss four viscoelastic testing to really be useful. It has to be done in a real-time way that the clinician can actually watch the formation of the graph and be able to actually act on it in real time rather than get this graph 3 hours later where, you know, the coagulopathy may not be the same as it was when it was initially measured. All in all, I think it's a really nice review. I encourage everyone to go read it, especially if you kind of want to get a better understanding of what viscoelastic monitoring is. But I think it does truly highlight how limited our data is on the utility of viscoelastic monitoring. And while it makes clinical sense in many areas, we don't really know if it'll lead to better outcomes.
Yeah, I think that's the key point is that we just don't have that great clinical data because we really need to have it at point of care, rapid turnaround tags or ROTEMs, which typically are just in your major trauma centers right now. And we haven't really deployed it out to your standard general community practice because it just doesn't come up as much. If you're not worried about massive transfusions and all sorts of nonsense like that on a routine basis, then you're just not going to have that much need for the TEG. I do agree that TEG is great. Thromboelastography is great. There's been nice studies showing that it can decrease the amount of transfusion requirements and other, in, say, like in liver cirrhosis, where you know all the laboratory parameters are going to be off. All your traditional coagulation parameters are going to be way off, but they're in their own specific sort of deranged hemostasis. And you don't actually need to transfuse them anything before their invasive procedure. And the TEG is a nice reassurance of that. So yeah, it's a great technology. It's just one of those things, like maybe 10 years from now, we'll all be using ultrasound for everything. And we'll all be using TEG for everything and everything will be different and new. But for now, it's, you know, it's still something, to learn about. And this is a great review article on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually key. I find it personally really helpful in cirrhosis, right? I think, you know, in it, when used simply, it can be used as like a harm reduction tool, right? In disease processes where we're encouraged to just transfuse based on numbers that are essentially meaningless, like the, you know, the INR in someone with liver disease, this gives you the encouragement that, no, this patient is not in a hypocoagulable state and often is hypercoagulable, and you're able to reduce those meaningless transfusion metrics. So I think those are probably some areas where there's a good yield in the emergency department. I think the other thing are some of the novel anticoagulants, right? Like where we don't have a really good measurement of if the patient is still coagulopathic or not. Having a TEG to be able to actually see if there's a persistent coagulopathy might be a nice harm reduction way to avoid some of the expensive antidotes.
Yeah, for sure. Because I mean, if you look at the idarucizumab trials, like 67% of the patients who were enrolled in the trial were actually taking their dabigatran to a therapeutic level, and the other 33% were not. So there were a whole bunch of people who got idarucizumab for a report of having taken their dabigatran when they had some sort of life-threatening bleeding, but didn't actually have it. So there's a, you know, the harm reduction strategy of using a TEG for that.
Well, I think that wraps us up for another month. As always, if anyone has any questions, comments, or concerns, we can reach at annalsaudio@asep.org. Until next month, this was Rory Spiegel and Ryan Radecki, and this was the Annals of Emergency Medicine podcast.